Hello and welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here with Faust. Faust is a fairly regular guest on Millennial. Let me just see how many times he's appeared. I think this might be the third or fourth time.
Third or fourth, I think, yes.
Yeah, it's the third time. All right. Well, why don't you introduce yourself briefly to the audience, just in case anyone doesn't know who you are?
Well, I used to be a fairly active member of the Dutch nationalist movement. I used to be involved with a group called Erkenbrand in 2016, and we made a bit of waves in the news back then. Quite a bit of waves in the news, to the point that there were major national news stories about it, and a lot of controversy later. I started on YouTube as an activist, and just kind of, you know, on the sort of reactionary, neo-reactionary sort of side of things, nationalism, particularly with a lot of Dutch aspects, because, of course, we share certain ideas all across Europe and across the Atlantic, but we've got our own peculiarities, such as, you know, Belgium shouldn't exist, things like that. And so I've been active in that for a number of years, but I have to admit that I've been less and less active lately.
Okay, but you are a commentator. You have a YouTube channel and I think you have a Dutch and an English YouTube channel. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we also, I work together with a Dutch-Belgian, or rather Dutch-Flemish, news website called React News, Rechtsactueel, which means right-wing news letters, sort of something like that. And we have a website also called Europodcasts, which we tried to sort of launch the idea of a European-based TRS radio network, but we didn't really get it off the ground, to be perfectly honest. But that does still exist if people want to look around, and that's also fairly Dutch-focused with some Hungarian and a few other things as well. And other than that, I do occasional stuff as a speaker and writer for other nationalist organizations like Voorpost.
All right. The Netherlands seems to be... first of all, does it really annoy you when people say Holland instead of the Netherlands?
Not particularly, but that's because I'm from one of the two provinces called Holland. Right. So to me, it doesn't bother me. But for people who are from Brabant or Zeeland, and they find that annoying very frequently. But I understand where it comes from because, of course, throughout the seafaring era that we actually were an important nation in the world, most of the ships and people came from Holland, so they would say they're from Holland. So the confusion is natural. It's like Pennsylvania Dutch in America, which are actually Germans. These little confusions happen. But doesn't bother me particularly. I don't like the name the Netherlands that much anyway. I prefer Dietland, which would be the name for a United Kingdom of the Netherlands, as it was in 1830 before the Belgium and Luxembourg split off.
Yeah. Well, we can get into various things there later on, but how would you characterize the Netherlands as a... Because some people think that it's quite a right-wing country. And obviously there is Amsterdam, which is extremely liberal, and I think it has a Jewish mayor. I can't remember now.
It does, yes.
Right, it does. And I know that you really don't like Amsterdam. And
no.
you've attacked me in the past for saying that I quite like Amsterdam. I really do like Amsterdam.
I understand. It's like it's a nice building. It's a nice town. It's just a shame about the people.
Yeah, and it is one of these. It's now a global city. And I've said before, you know, I was there. I visited in 2001, and it felt very different from when I visited it later in 2016. Or no, sorry, 2017, I think it was.
2017, I think, yeah.
It was Rotterdam in 2016. And it felt very different then. You know, in those 16 years, things had really changed and it had become what is called a global city.
I'll tell you, it's accelerating rapidly. You don't see many pride flags around the country, except in cities like Amsterdam. And then it's not just a pride flag. That's the ones with the progress pride flag with the triangle, or ones with a black power fist. The last time I was in Amsterdam was during one of those anti-corona demonstrations, and they were absolutely everywhere. I was shocked at how fast that had come up as a cultural thing. You see that mostly in the big progressive cities like Utrecht and Amsterdam, and you don't see it so much anywhere else. There's a huge divide in the Netherlands between the countryside and the urban cities, because there really is a culture of sort of detached urbanite people who vote for progressive parties and who control the media and so on. And then there's a lot of normal people still around who vote for more right-wing parties. Because as you say, the perception of the Netherlands is it's kind of two-faced. Like on the one side, we have the reputation of Amsterdam and drugs and abortion and so on. And every time someone accuses us of being progressive, I say, well, at this point, we're less progressive than half of the American states. You know, they've got more liberal abortion laws, more liberal drug laws than we do. And on the other hand, we also have our own Bible Belt, and we've got a fairly large representation of populist politics in parliament. So there's a strong right wing. There's also a very big progressive cancer. But at this point, the progressive cancer is not unique to our country anymore. Although maybe at one point we were a little ahead of the curve.
Definitely not. In 2017, I visited and we went to various Dutch cities, and I made a set of videos, and one of those videos was just you talking about the different political parties, because there, one of the things about the Netherlands is that it has a parlamentary system that there are many, many parties, unlike in Britain, where, you know, there's the Tories, the Labour and Lib Dems.
We're
and
now at 20.
Nothing else really matters. So yeah. Well, here's the picture from back then that was used in the video. I don't know, are some of these parties
A lot of them are still around. Some of the faces have changed. You'll notice a few on there, like the Pirate Party, and a number of splinter parties, but there's also the major ones. But this is fairly few. At this point, we're actually at 20 parties in parliament, and that's actually a record for the country. After last election, it was 18, then some people split off and formed new parties, and now we're at 20. And no single party has an absolute majority over here. So the biggest party currently has 36 seats out of 150, so you always need coalitions, which means there's a lot more consensus building necessary. But what kind of generally happens is that all the progressive parties band together and keep all the populists and right-wingers out.
Yeah, which is, and that has happened in other countries as well. I'm pretty sure it happened in France with the Front National. I'm pretty sure it happened in Germany with the AfD. I can't remember where else now. But
the Front National and AfD, if you were to look at sort of the populist and right-wing parties that you could really call right-wing, there's three. There's the well-known PVV of Geert Wilders, who is mostly anti-immigration, anti-Islam, and is very pro-Israel. You've got Forum for Democracy, which has veered into a very sort of QAnon-esque anti-corona conspiracy vibe, but which occasionally goes extremely far to the right with very radical positions. And then you've got the old hardline Calvinist party, the SGP, and those are basically religious fundamentalists who want to, you know, their party platform includes taking the vote away from women, for example.
Fucking hell. Would you say that the Netherlands is a very high IQ country?
Well, yes. We are very well represented among the inventors in history. Of course, the average IQ keeps going down, and we're one of the few countries that keeps good statistics on, you know, ethnic backgrounds and school averages, crime averages, all these sorts of things. We have a government database that keeps up with this. But somehow they can never explain why year on year the average scores go down while the ethnic percentages keep shifting. It's a mystery that they simply can't explain.
Amazing. And well, that's the whole thing about diversity not being a strength. But yeah, I don't know if we want to, how far, how based we want to get in our commentary on that. But it is amazing that they keep this going and keep this, and even say, you know, diversity really is a biological strength, that different groups mixing and you get the best of each group. But there's no reason why that would actually happen. You might as, you, just as likely you would get the worst of each group. It's entirely random. So,
yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's the thing. They track those figures over here, and that's all you're all able to find that in open databases. But of course, you can't talk about it unless your perspective is, why do these Moroccans keep having average lower grades? We really need to do something about this. You know, if you give, it's the well-known phenomena where if you describe an existing a situation from a progressive lens, you can say all these things, and if you just shift the way you talk about it slightly, then you're not allowed to say it. But I believe you wanted to talk a little bit about what's been happening over here lately with...
But just before I'm, because I ended up looking through that folder, I found some old photos of you and me from that tour. So here's one, that this is us. Gosh, look how much younger. Yeah. we look so young and full of vigor and full of life and optimism there. And then there's this one. Oh, wow. Gosh, I was a mess. Back. Anyway, I needed a haircut. I apologize for that. But look, again, we're so young and optimistic there. But yeah, that was 2017.
Only 5 years, yeah.
Amazing, isn't it? Anyway, so there we go. Just trip down memory lane. I mean, I could show you more, but I don't want to bore people with a nostalgia tour. Let me see. I don't know if there actually are any more of the two of us. I don't think so. So anyway, that's something.
It has been a while since you've been over here, though.
It has. Well, the whole COVID thing happened. I mean, you know, I've said this to you before, and it's not. I'm not just saying it because it's you. The Netherlands is my favorite country outside of Britain. And I do really like it, not just because of Amsterdam. I just like the general feel of the country. And that's why I asked you if it's a high IQ country, because frankly, it feels like a high IQ country. It feels like a place that is very well run, very organized, very advanced,
we're
peaceful and civilized.
Like,
you know, it's nice. I like it very much.
We're like Germans who have a little bit of a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Yeah. Germans with a bit of the random element of the Brit that is in the British psyche. It's like
we're in between both cultures a little bit. Yeah,
exactly.
Although,
exactly.
There's a unique Dutch characteristic which I don't see in either side is our directness, which I don't see with Brits being very polite and Germans, of course, being very reserved. The Dutch will always tell you exactly what the thing is. You know, they'll tell you exactly to your face, like, you need to get a haircut. And it's not meant to be insulting, but it's just like an objective opinion of, like, you need to get a haircut.
Yeah.
Because you do.
Well, even now, right now, are you critiquing my hairstyle right now? I certainly hope you're not doing that. We're barely even 15 minutes into the... You're already insulting me. No, I know. I'm sorry. All right, so let's get to the serious stuff then.
Yeah.
Because this is what I wanted to talk about. This one of the big stories this year was there was the huge convoy with the trucks in Canada, but there was a very similar thing in the Netherlands as well. And what was interesting was that this, like the Canadian convoy story, this was really muted in news coverage elsewhere. It took ages for the BBC in Britain to acknowledge the Canadian convoy, and it took them months, literally months, like I think 3 or 4 months to acknowledge what was going on in the Netherlands. So, but it was a huge thing, and you can see that just from the photos of it. I mean, it was really massive numbers of tractors, farmers clogging up the motorways and so on. So why don't you lay the groundwork for this and explain what was going on?
This started about 3 or 4 years ago. It started before COVID anyway. And the government had basically said that there is an issue with nitrogen pollution. At first, it was mostly about gas, but now it's about soil pollution as well. And it has to do, for example, with overuse of fertilizer in the ground. To be perfectly honest, this is not completely fictional. The Netherlands is a huge agricultural producer. We export a massive amount. We're the second largest exporter worldwide per volume in terms of capital of agricultural goods. First one being America, second one being us, although we're more in specialized stuff like tulips, for example. That's not a meme. We actually sell millions and millions worth of tulips every year. So there is an actual issue with nitrogen pollution there. But the government took a few measures. For example, we used to be able to drive 130, now it's 100. And they started escalating this rhetoric more and more and aiming it specifically at farmers. And the whole discussion about air pollution and so on, that's kind of disappeared. And it's all about the nitrogen pollution. That's the excuse they use. And what they want to do is they want to disown farmers. They want to significantly reduce farming in the Netherlands. And they mostly take aim at livestock. So cattle farming, ranching, pigs, chickens, these are, you know, massive industrial meat production. They're also targeting just your regular wheat and potato farms, but mostly it's aimed at meat production. And the official policy is, of course, just because it's necessary for the environment. The more or less fairly mainstream accepted reality is that they want to disown farmers so they can build at least a million more houses, which they have also accepted as a government policy. And there's a document which was from, I think, the EU, which was leaked years ago, called the Tri-City Project, which would turn the Netherlands into sort of like the industrial zone of Europe in between London, Paris, and Berlin, being also the communications and highway and transport hub for the major northern economic zone of Europe. And for that, it would basically turn the entirety of the Netherlands into one mega city. Now, the Netherlands is already the most densely populated and most is quite high. And there's no intent to stop this. There's a net average net migration of about 55,000 people per year. And they say that we'll be at about 20 million within the next 10 years.
Well, hold on a second. 20 million new people in the Netherlands?
No, total. Will there be a total population of 20 million?
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Your camera seems to have frozen, by the way. I don't know why. I'm not sure what's going on. The audio is fine, though. So don't worry about that.
See if we can fix that.
Weird.
Anyway, so sort of like the conspiracy is that they want to disown. I'll just switch it off. Just take away farmland to realize this Tri-City State project and to continue urbanizing the country. There's also, of course, the angle of eat the bugs sort of thing, with them wanting to reduce meat production, because as I said, they're specifically targeting the livestock farming. I honestly think that we do produce too much meat. For example, we export something like 7 million pigs to China yearly. We really don't need to be exporting to China. You know, there's as a nationalist, you should be an environmentalist. You need to, you know, maintain your habitat and your environment and a healthy environment for your future generations. So why are we raising 7 million pigs to ship them over to China? I couldn't tell you. But the whole idea seems to be, you know, to just decrease meat production in general. And so what happened is that farmers at first protested. Then they started using tools that they had available to them, which are tractors. And at first it was demonstrations in the capital, the political capital, The Hague, so not Amsterdam, where they would line up their tractors and just do a regular demonstration issues, telling their grievances. This would usually result in them being surrounded by police and even the military, and then kind of forced out of town. So they switched tactics to blocking highways. They occupied the national broadcaster at one point. And things kind of slowed down during the 2 years that COVID took the upper hand in rhetoric. Farmers were quite present at the anti-corona lockdown demonstrations, which in the Netherlands, there were quite large anti-lockdown demos, and they escalated into violence with people fighting in the streets at several points. At one point in Rotterdam, police cars were set on fire and the police shot three people. And there were quite a lot of street fights between the MA, the riot police, and people in the streets. Then in spring of this year, when the corona issue started dying down and things were opened up again, media and politics switched back to the whole disowning farmers agenda. And they really started pushing that faster and faster. They passed through motions to appropriate lands, to forced buyouts. And so farmers got back under taxes. But you saw a huge sort of popular support as well. The country's kind of divided on the issue, where you could they have the Dutch flag, but then they switch it upside down, so it's like the Yugoslavian flag. It's blue, white, red. And you see that absolutely everywhere when you're outside of the big city. So they've got a lot of popular support. And they started doing things like they started surrounding and blocking supply depots for supermarkets so they couldn't provide food to the cities. They started again blocking highways, setting fires on highways. They went to visit politicians' homes, these sort of things. And at this point, they've done just about all forms of protests short of escalating into terrorism or insurrection. And I don't think they will do that, and I don't think they have anything to gain by that. But at the same time, nothing that they do has had enough of an effect to change the course of the political establishment. So the situation as it is right now is that most farmers, and especially in the livestock area, are being slowly disowned, being bought out, and that the demonstrations that they've been doing have been slowing down because they're not having any effect. And it has escalated to violence also at multiple points. And this was all interrupted with the yearly, we have Sinterklaas as well as Christmas over here. So recently we had our yearly Zwarte Piet riots. So the farmers' issue was pushed aside, and then we had to fight about blackface for about a month, which we do every year here. And it, I mean literally fighting. I mean, this year there were only about three or four major riots. But in previous years, things happened like Antifa activists would attack people dressed as Zwarte Piet and vice versa. Things like in the Rotterdam, there was at the city center, at the bridge, there was a huge fight that lasted about 5 hours between several thousand pro and anti-Zwarte Piet supporters. In Hilversum, anti-Zwarte Piet protesters had to flee to a police station because they were attacked by a mob. Things like that happen a lot. And then now we're, during the holidays, not much is happening. And I expect in spring, the farmer thing will start up again. But to be honest, as I say, they've done hefty activism. They've done what the truckers did. They've occupied the capital. They've blocked food supplies. They've blocked highways. They've blocked the national broadcaster. I don't think there's much they can do to escalate anymore. And nothing seems to have worked.
And you said that they had a lot of public support.
Yes.
I mean,
it seems that if there were elections now, there's a party called the Farmer Citizen Movement. They would go from having one seat to about 12 seats, meaning about 10-ish percent of the vote. And most of the establishment parties would lose quite a lot of seats. But elections are 2 years away, and in 2 years' time, they can still push a lot of this through.
Yeah. I did create a graphic so as to cover the fact that your camera hasn't worked. And I chose a Dutch tulip field because you mentioned that earlier. So here it is. I don't know if people prefer that, but it this goes to show, I mean, it's a nice image, it's quite pretty, but it shows, it's an indication of what the Netherlands is like. I mean, you can see how organized this is. You can just see that that is a high IQ country. It could not happen. I mean, it's so tidy, it's so efficient. It's yeah. like a Lego set almost.
Every inch of land here has what we call a bestemmingsplan. So every area has a sort of report which the government has decided what this area is allowed to be used for. So it's either it's woodland, it's farmland, it's building area, it's industrial, it's commercial, residential, and that's every inch. And to change that, it's a whole bureaucratic process. So yeah, it's very organized in the sense that literally every inch of land is regulated.
Yeah. But I mean, the result is a very well organized country. I mean, you know, I know the bureaucracy is always annoying. It's always a pisser. But, you know, the result is that. I mean, it looks amazing. It looks like a highly successful country that's doing very well. But anyway, I just thought that would be a fitting substitute for the camera. But I've realized that it obscures the graphic and all of that. So I'll just switch back to this. But either way, it was a nice wee thing to show people. I guess this comes back to how much public support can the farmers get? How relevant is this to people's lives who aren't farmers? Will they care? Can you make them care? Should they care? I mean, what would you say about this?
Well, quite a lot of people sort of took the angle that, well, food security is quite important, and Corona has demonstrated how international markets and the world economy can be disrupted, and we would be fools to start destroying our own agricultural sector in times like these, especially with a recession and so on coming. So there's quite a few people, even in the mainstream, who take that sort of an argument. But as I say, it seems to just completely fall on deaf ears. There's quite a few arguments made for and against. And to be perfectly honest, I do think there are arguments to be made that our farming as we do it today is not maybe the most environmentally friendly. But that discussion is not what's on the mainstream. The discussion is either the farmers need to go or food security. And it doesn't seem to budge anywhere from there, but it doesn't seem to affect the discussion in the political sphere at all. Because what literally happened during COVID also happens now, where we had things happen like whenever politicians from the opposition went to speak on the Corona issue, the minister who has to be present just turned his back and ignored them. And they do the same thing with the farmers. They just completely ignore any voiced opposition by politicians. The media is, of course, squarely behind the established parties. That's predictable. And we don't have that much of a strong alternative media over here. There's a few YouTube channels. There's a few websites. There's even one broadcaster, but it's not very strong. We've got a relatively healthy populist movement in terms of parliamentary. There's a bit of a nationalist movement on the ground, but we don't have like America or Britain, like a lot of YouTube figures for these sort of things, a lot of sort of alternative media that covers these sorts of things. There's relatively little.
Yeah. How big a thing do you think this could become, or do you think it has already peaked and is now just going to sink into public acquiescence to the regime?
I think it has sort of peaked, yes, because the only way it could still change if there was in some way early elections, which I don't see happening. The only way that this is going to change at all is if elections are forced to happen, because as I say, the activism hasn't changed anything. It's the same thing with the Corona, you know, the anti-lockdown demonstrations. The police just beat people into hospital until they stopped. Over here, the farmers get intimidated or ignored until they stop. And the policy is not changed. And like I said, they've already gone up to the limit of what is legal. Their only step up from this is literally engaging in violent tactics. And I, again, I think that would turn a lot of their support against them. And I don't think they would really win anything by that. So I'm a bit blackpilled.
Yeah, I mean, you can get away with that kind of thing when the media is on your side, as we've seen in it with various left wing causes in the past. But when the media is not on your side, if you try that, you'll find out that actually the public don't join you because the public are being told by the media that you're a violent, murderous terrorist group. But I mean, what are the implications here? Because as you said, I mean, well, what I read at the time was that the Dutch government wants to shut down 3,000 farms.
No, that's just the first step. That's just the first step they've taken.
And I mean, how many farmers are there in the Netherlands? I would be surprised. Oh,
there's a lot. I wouldn't know exact figures, but 3,000 was a fairly insignificant portion of it.
That's incredible. What I read was that they wanted to shut down they wanted to reduce the farming sector by 30%.
Yeah, and sometimes they talk about half.
I mean, this is just astonishing. That seems incredible. It seems like that would fundamentally change the entire country.
Yes, but I think that's exactly like if you would say this in any form of mainstream media, they would call you conspiracy theorists. But I genuinely do think that the idea is to transform this into sort of a mega city. Like I say, it's already a fairly urbanized country. We've got the biggest port in Europe. There's a huge banking and industrial sector here. It's very densely populated. I think there's something to that Tri-City project. If you look it up, you'll find a number of documents on it, official documents from the EU, namely. And the whole idea is basically to just turn this into the industrial heartland, the Netherlands. And this would mean, well, we already don't have much nature, but then all of it would be gone.
I mean, it's such an incredible thing that I don't really know what to say. And this is how I felt when I first heard about this. I think whenever that was, March or April. I don't even know what to say. I don't know what to ask about it. It's amazing that we have world engineers who are talking in these terms about just transforming an entire country.
But they deny it at every turn. And if anyone asks it, if it ever is mentioned in parliament or in the media, they deny it. But a funny thing, for example, is our current prime minister, Mark Rutte, was asked about Klaus Schwab. And at first he said he didn't know who that was and he never had anything to do with him. And then it turned out he actually wrote the foreword and introduction to one of Klaus Schwab's books. So... You know, they're not going to just openly tell you what their plans are. Apparently Klaus Schwab does, but not our government, at least.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. And they don't seem to care about any consistency here. Sometimes they'll just say openly, yeah, that's what we're doing. And sometimes they'll say, you must be insane to suggest that that's what we're doing. I mean, the level of insincerity and gaslighting is amazing. But actually, it reminds me of something that I saw just, I think, 2 days ago in Britain. There was a thing that the city of Oxfordshire is going to implement some new thing where people were saying climate lockdowns, where it's a difficult thing to describe exactly, but they're going to limit or try to limit how much people drive cars. They're going to be monitoring that. And they want everything to be within 15 minutes walking distance from your house, so everything that you could possibly need. Now, you know, on the face of it, that sounds like a laudable goal. It sounds, okay, it's a nice life, you know. But it's coming from people who clearly aren't, they don't have people's best interests at heart. They are technocrats. They are megalomaniacs. They are idealists in a way. Absolutists, I guess, would be a better
as a friend of mine often says, they're not technocrats, because real technocrats would actually look at the data.
So I guess that, yeah, that would imply idealists. Well, but what happened with this story was it got out because it was announced that they're going to do this, I think, in 2024 in Oxfordshire. And that led to pushback. So then the councillors who were responsible for it got attacked on social media. I think they got accosted in real life. I'm not sure. So then there was a BBC article saying that people had got entirely the wrong idea about this scheme. And they were attacking these councillors needlessly. And it was all conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
But they described described the scheme, that what it actually is. And it sounded like exactly what the conspiracy theorists were saying.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what confusion are they claiming took place here. This sounds similar to what you were describing in the Netherlands, where they'll just claim, no, you've got the wrong idea. It's not A, it's A. And so you're obviously very confused.
They'll say, no, we're not disowning farmers to urbanize the country or getting more migrants or whatever. But at the same time, they've adopted a law which is kind of a strange law. It's an originally a martial law from the Second World War, slightly before the Second World War, which would, under special circumstances, allow the government to take property away from people if they are in a direct imminent danger. So the original purpose of the law was, like, if you're a civilian and the front line comes near to your house, the military is allowed to just kick you out of your house because that's for your own safety and you need to be away from the front lines. They've readopted that law now and reworded it so they could technically disown anyone. And people think this is mostly so they could more easily disown farmland and farmers. But theoretically, it could be also for housing in general. And we've had a policy for quite a while now that in the Netherlands, there's a thing called social housing. So if you're below a certain income, you can apply to be on a list and then the government will provide. I think in Britain, it's called a council house.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing. Yeah.
And there's waiting lists for those. And so if you're Dutch and you're poor, you could be up to 10 years, 5 to 10 years on a waiting list like that until you get a home. But the migrants, asylum seekers, as they call them, get priority. So they are put into new built homes first. At the same time, they've got an official government policy that they'll be building 1 million new homes before 2030. And by 2030, all cars in the Netherlands have to be electric. We've got to have 30% of our power production from renewable sources, etc., etc. So you could put all of these things together and say, well, this does sound like replacement migration. This does sound like Agenda 2030. This does sound a lot like, like the Tri-State City Project. And they'll say, like, no, you're crazy. It's just total coincidence that all of these policies would perfectly serve towards such a goal.
Yeah, I guess in previous eras, we would have a media that would hold them, that would take them to task for that and would hold their feet to the fire, as it were, and say, right, so you've just admitted that it's... But in this age, we have a media that says, okay, that's the answer. There we go. That's that done.
Well, that's the funny thing. We have a political party that'll do that, Forum for Democracy, and they'll go like, okay, but you did write the introduction to Klaus Schwab's book, and your policies do seem to be coinciding with these statements that they've made about what society should be going towards. And then the media will just double down and say, these people are absolutely insane. We should read. That's another one. They've recently looked at one of the Forum for Democracy is not very good at their managing their PR. So one of their members of parliament said that he would not be surprised if at some point all the aggrieved parties from Corona and farmers and so on would occupy parliament and maybe some heads would roll. And this resulted in one of the established parties, D66, saying that they should introduce new legislation that would allow them to ban politically extremist parties, which is something they're looking at now. So
that's going on in several countries. I know that Germany is definitely making moves to ban the AfD, for example. But on the matter of denial of the World Economic Forum, I've seen this in Ireland. I've seen it in Canada. I've seen it in the Netherlands. I think I've seen it in another country as well, but it's not coming to mind. That's three countries where I've seen people in the parliament raising the matter of the World Economic Forum.
Yes.
And what happens is, so this lone politician, and, you know, I've got to say that these people, it must take a lot of balls to do this. One lone politician will bring up this matter and basically say, a lot of the other people in this room are involved with a shady organization that has openly said that it wants to do X, Y, and Z undemocratically. And it's stuff that the public would object to. A lot of the people in this room are part of an organization that is clandestine and yet brazen and open and is involved with stuff that the public don't want.
Yeah.
And yet none of you will admit it. And what happens is the rest of the room just erupts in laughter because it's such a far-fetched thing to say. It sounds conspiratorial. It sounds like something from an espionage thriller storyline or something, where this shady organization that's getting into all these governments. But the very same people laughing are themselves involved in it. And as I say, I've seen this in Ireland, Canada, and the Netherlands, and I think elsewhere as well, where this is just their attitude. This is how they deal with it. This is how they handle the accusation that they're involved in a conspiracy. They say, that's a bit far-fetched, isn't it?
I think
that seems to work.
I think a lot of the lower level politicians and journalists and so on don't even know that they're part of a conspiracy. That's the whole idea of the cathedral, of course. It does seem like in the last 2 to 3 years they've really stepped on the accelerator, though. Couldn't really tell you what the cause exactly for it is, but they've really, really stepped speeding things up. And you saw a lot of these things. For example, there was a group of Europarliamentarians who demanded to see all the deals that the European Union had made with, for example, Pfizer and Moderna with the buying of the vaccines. And they just received 100 pages of completely blacked out reports, which were the official documents, but they were completely blacked out. And when they said, well, we can't as a parliament do our job like this, they were just ignored. And things like that happen all the time, you know. We've got in the Netherlands like transparency laws, so parties like the PVV and Forum will demand openness of administration, and then the government hands over these documents, but they're all blacked out, and then they'll always say, well, it's a state security issue, we can't publish those. So the whole thing, like the illusion of, like, and then they'll say, oh, but we need to ban these politically extremist parties to protect democracy. Whereas, what democracy if the parliament can't control the government, if governments aren't open about the policies that they're implementing and the goals behind them, if politicians aren't open who they talk with, who they know, who they deal with? So I do think for quite a lot of people, they are being forced with their noses into the fact that we do not live in the liberal democracy of the 90s anymore. And they are simply being forced to face that harsh reality. I think Corona and the lockdowns woke quite a lot of people to that up. And each time something like this happens, some people wake up. But that's, you know, my whole attitude lately has been, we all know the problems. It doesn't seem like anyone's going to be fixing them, though.
Well, I think a part of it is, as I said, people can't quite believe that the problem is real. Because it's so far-fetched. It does sound far-fetched and conspiratorial and paranoid to say
it also forces
our countries are being taken over.
it does not allow you to take a passive attitude in life anymore. If you live in a government that actively seeks to destroy just about everything that you would consider normal, and is completely going against your own interest, because let's not forget things like, for example, CBDCs, you know, central bank digital currencies, where they will want to make the entire economy centrally controlled, or at least the fiat aspect of it, making it impossible for to make untraceable transactions and being able to just take your money away from you without the intervention of banks. That's something that happened in the Netherlands as well. Under an anti-terrorism law, quite a few dissident organizations like publishers and media and even private individuals were debanked, which is something that we've seen in America before, but was in Europe, I think, fairly unseen until now. But on the whole, I think people are waking up, government stepping up repression, and I don't really see how things are going to change. I think Italy is maybe a test case with the new right-wing government over there. There's still some hope in Hungary. But we have to see. I mean, there was always the hope that the Eastern European countries would sort of try to work against the course the EU is going in. But then Russia kind of threw dirt into that whole plan, with now the Polish being really pro-America and that affecting their attitude within the EU as well. So, you know, my attitude has been basically that I'm focusing mostly on working in a career so I can buy a compound and hide there in the woods until things blow over.
Yeah, I can understand that. And this is something that I've said myself, that I think people should be trying to better their own position simply so that they can weather whatever comes, because it might, you don't know, maybe civilized life, as you know, if you can call this civilized life, maybe this will continue indefinitely. But you as a political dissident will not be welcome there. You will not be treated well there. So you'll want to be able to go off on your own. Or maybe it will all fall apart, in which case you'll want the resources to be able to go off to the live in the woods. Either way, but even if it all is all right, you know, if they do this technocratic takeover and or whatever you want to call it, and they tolerate us, well, we still wouldn't be happy in that. So again, you would want the option of going to live in the woods.
Brave New World, where they have the reservations where you can go off and live like a native.
You know, Klaus Schwab even mentioned this in one of his, I think it was in one of his articles I read somewhere, that he said there will be people who don't, and he was referring basically to smart cities, that this is what they're building, this is what they're going for. Everything will be metered, everything will be surveilled, everything will be recorded and monitored and tested and balanced and all the rest of it. And he said that will be the norm. And there will be some people who don't want to be part of that. And they will live out in, I can't remember exactly what he said, but basically he was acknowledging that there will be some people who are nomads, vagrants, you know, outsiders, they'll be not part of mainstream society, because mainstream society will be, you know, mega city one yes. kind of thing. So there will be a lot of people who really don't. And I think he, because you never know what his attitude is to those people, or how much his own personal attitude even matters. I don't know how much authority he actually had. But either way, he was acknowledging that there will be people who just don't want to be part of this, which is interesting. You know, it's an interesting acknowledgement. It could be good or bad that he's acknowledging that.
I've for a long time been sort of an advocate for Arcofuturism, and I think the only way out of the dystopian Earth is to colonize other planets so that we can have a frontier again and get away from sort of the central empire, which is full of degeneracy and so on. You can go to Spengler, for example, and a lot of these authors who say that culture is formed away from the major cities and major cities are just culture destroyers. You can take things like the idea of IQ shredders from neo-reactionary philosophy and so on. And on the whole, I really think that the only way forward is through more technology, as maybe contrary to logic as that might sound. I really generally do think that if we don't have frontiers, if we don't have new territory to explore and expand into, then we'll sort of eat ourselves up.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that space exploration is necessary. I mean, I mean necessarily psychologically, spiritually. And, you know, actually the speech that I gave at Erkenbrand in 2017 was very science fiction-y. Some people didn't like it for that reason. But the sort of implicit in that whole vision there was that we cannot, European man is not going to be satisfied with Europe or with even just planet Earth. He needs to expand. He needs to conquer. He needs to explore. He needs to venture into where no man has gone before and all that. But literally, it's a difficult one because I know I'm not the kind of guy to do that. And I'm not an explorer. I'm not a conqueror or whatever. But at the same time, I'm happy to conquer things, creative challenges. That's my thing. But I know that a large number of white men, European men, need new things, new places to expand to. And, whether it's in the old days, a foreign country, a new continent, an unexplored continent, or even the depths of the ocean. But more likely still is other planets.
Philosophy and understanding of the natural world.
There's
desire for knowledge, understanding, and discovering the unknown. And I think that's why they want us dead, because we're too threatening and too difficult to deal with. Something they didn't know.
No, but it's not a black pill though. That's actually a really good white pill to remind ourselves of why it is that they're doing all. I mean, why are they funneling Africans into European countries? You know, it's
because there's a few interesting things that might sabotage this whole project, regardless, because of. You do still need a population of high enough IQ to maintain the sort of Goislop producing factories and bad entertainment. You see this with the general level, to keep to your field of arts, the general level of writing and entertainment has taken a sharp decline in the last decade and a half. And I mean, it maybe you could say that it's been declining for longer than that, but it's really noticeable lately. And I think even... quite a lot of normies aren't satisfied anymore with that level of absolute cultural abyss that is presented to them by the mainstream. So the competence, and this is something, for example, the United States military can't get enough nuclear engineers to actually maintain all of its facilities, etc., etc. So the human capital is declining. And then there's challenges, for example, like there's microplastics in your blood right now. Is that not going to be a health issue at some point, you know? There's worldwide an absolute downward trend in births to the point that you might be concerned about the very continuation of the existence of the species, because even in Africa, the average birth is now below 5 per woman, where it used to be 8. And in most of every developed nation, it's below 2, including China, and India's downward trending towards 2.5. So there's challenges there that, well, they are obsessed with their own little power plays and power politics. Major issues are accumulating that could just derail the whole thing into a civilizational crisis in a way that wouldn't exactly help us, but would certainly sabotage their project.
Well, I certainly hope that we can get the African birth rate up, because that doesn't bear thinking about how that would change life on Earth. I'm joking, Faust, don't worry. I guess the question there is how... I wonder if they're aware of this. See, this is always the question, because you see them destroying systematically, proudly, openly, destroying these countries and the gene pools that they rely on. And some people think, well, they must have a plan. They must have a plan for dealing with this. They must be confident that, and by they, we mean the powers that be, the globalists, whatever. They're doing this. So they mustn't be that concerned about the quality of the gene pool. Otherwise, they wouldn't be, well, doing things to reduce that.
But this is the thing,
but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, maybe they're so high on their own supply, they actually believe in racial equality.
I think they are, because you see experts in almost every field, every time one of these things comes up, being genuinely concerned about what the general trend of politics, media, and culture is doing. Because, for example, during COVID, you had a lot of economists and doctors being dissidents. Quite a number of prominent doctors and economists were very opposed to, well, the bailout programs for the economists and, of course, the vaccine programs and so on for doctors. And these sorts of things happen more and more, where a lot of experts within a field start, who are, you know, actually trying to be experts in their field and not just being careerists, establishment figures, start wondering, well, hold on, this doesn't seem to be going in the right direction. And I generally think that that might be where change might come from, where a sufficiently large amount of intellectuals, intelligent people, start being so disenfranchised from the system that they see no other option but to try and start forming a new elite, which is, of course, not a new idea. But
it's an exciting idea.
Sure, it's an exciting idea, but I don't think we're at the position yet where, firstly, the establishment knows that this is a risk, so they do everything to try and avoid and discourage it. It's something I've noticed with friends from who've been in this movement for a longer time, and I have this same issue myself, is that if you are an intelligent person and if you are capable, it's quite easy to become entrapped by still the promises of wealth and career that the system offers you. And eventually you become too afraid to stay an activist. I've seen this happen with a number of people. And to be perfectly honest, it's not that I'm afraid, otherwise I wouldn't be on this stream, for example. But career has taken priority because, well,
because you're a guy. I mean, you're living in the real world.
Yeah.
It's understandable.
So, yeah, I think it will eventually have to go that way if there's to be any change at all, or otherwise it will derail into complete catastrophe. And maybe they'll achieve their dream, but to be honest, I don't think that's going to be able to maintain itself for very long.
That's my feeling as well. And sometimes maybe I'm kidding myself. You know, I'm not sure, but I just feel that this isn't sustainable. It's an open contradiction. You can't sustain a high level civilization with low IQ drones. You're just not. It's just can't. I just don't see how you can do that. I mean, one solution would be just to have everything so systematized that you didn't need intelligent people around anymore in large numbers in order to do it. Perhaps another way to do it would be with a very vicious police state that just, and you know, we've kind of got that, you know, well, you can feel it just now, that just immediately clamped down on anything that was a problem.
You hear a lot of talk in those circles about AI, so they do seem to be betting on AI quite heavily as a substitute for maintenance. And then the really hardline dictatorship, well, you've got the test case of communist China for that one. Did you hear the story where there were these protests against the lockdown system because they had the zero COVID policy, right? So if you were in an area where there was COVID, they would do lockdown. They would literally weld the door shut and everything. And they were doing that up until a few weeks ago still. So they were still had absolute total lockdowns. It's actually part of the reason why there's still massive economic disruption worldwide, because there's still a supply side issue from China still not being up to the production level pre-COVID. But an incident that happened was they had welded shut one of these big apartment complexes. A fire started due to the whole lockdown process. Fire brigade couldn't get there in time, and the whole thing burned down. And cell phone footage of, you know, women jumping out of windows holding their babies and so on started circulating. And then demonstrations against the lockdown started throughout China, which was called the white paper movement, where they would hold up a white piece of paper because they couldn't say anything because they'd literally put it into a work camp. But, well, you know, a blank sheet of paper was sort of issues protest. And the funny thing was the Communist Party switched on a dime, turned 180 degrees. And whereas it was previously forbidden to say that Corona was not dangerous, that it was just a flu. Now it's forbidden to say that it is dangerous. And you know what they said? They said traditional Chinese medicine had cured corona. And now it's over and we're just going to go back. So, you know, you see the incompetence of the totalitarian state there as well. There seems to be like even a National Socialist, if they had had more time, probably would have decayed into this sort of level of incompetence, just as the Soviet Union started with at least some quite capable people and then degenerated into total farcical incompetence, where they would, you know, have production quotas for nails, so they just make a 10-ton nail so they'd fill their production quotas, things like that. So I think the tyrannical solution has a lot less chance of succeeding than the system that they seem to be implementing now, with the soft control through the media and the politics, and just saying that you're absolutely crazy for seeing all these coincidental policies as some sort of framework that they're working in. So I really do think that this system seems to be the way that they're going to go forward, because the tyrannical state has this tendency to degenerate far faster into almost Monty Python-esque incompetence.
Yeah, I agree. It's brittle, it's fragile, and it degrades very quickly. But even so they're choosing this soft tyranny instead, and I agree with you on that. But I still say, as I said earlier, that I don't think this will work in the long term, because it even though it's more flexible and versatile, it's still basically destroying everything. And it's destroying everything that we care about, destroying everything that we love, destroying our countries, destroying our societies. The question will be, I don't want to get into dangerous territory, but I guess the question is, what will be salvageable by the time a sufficient number of people wake up to this? What will there be for them to do to get it back? But either way, I do think that a lot of people will leave the West of their own accord once they feel that, okay, it's no longer safe here. This is a degenerating society. It's falling apart. We're not welcome anymore. You know, I think that will happen.
But they will want to make sure, as you said, in Brave New World, there's, you know, the totalitarian society, and there's the reservations you can go to. And the trend of this particular ideology seems to be that they could not live with the idea that there would be someone out there disagreeing with them. So the West would come after you, to put it that way, you know. You think you can hide at the southern tip of Antarctica? No, they'll come after you even there. And yeah. Maybe you can get away with it for a few generations. You know, maybe you can go into the Amazon rainforest and hide out there for a long time. But I think if nothing changes, they'll keep coming after you.
Yeah. But as I say, I don't think they'll get to that point.
No, maybe.
I mean, and I do have to believe that, because otherwise I'd be black-pilled and despairing. But it just doesn't seem likely to me. I think that they're overreaching. I think that they're creating something that they're not going to be able to maintain. And they're also creating something that's going to drive the population mad.
Well, the population is already mad.
Yeah, but I think it will get a lot worse. I mean, you know, especially with the resource shortages, but also especially with population replacement.
I mean, think of it this way.
Sorry, go
on. Even if the maddest mad ideas of the last 20 years were to be taken away in reverse, things have already gone to, you know, the general acceptance of absolutely crazy ideas is already at a point that even if you were to undo the last 20 years, there's quite a lot of bad ideas in there already. You go back to your Fukuyama sort of liberal idea and end of history, and it would just cycle down into this sort of post-humanity creation, you know, dominance over creation sort of idea anyway. So
Homo Deus.
What you really need is a new philosophy led by dissident elites. But the new philosophy, that's the thing. That's why I'm not so active anymore. I don't see charismatic leaders. I don't see successful movements. I don't see much of anything changing things. And the things that do change, for example, the elections in Italy, which I do think are a hopeful sign, or, for example, Orban managing to hold on to power in Hungary, these are very much demagogic populists who are responding to very surface-level tensions within the population, and not deep thinkers with new ideas who are going to radically change anything.
Yeah, they don't, as you say, they don't seem to really understand the depths of what's going on and the depths of the problems. in society. But even so, all of this, I think, is going to become manifest. I mean, you're already seeing it. And yes, society was bad 20 years ago. It's bad now. It's going to get worse. There's no question of that. And, you know, I even think that our opposition know this in some sense. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're trying to shut us up. They're trying to say to stop us from sounding the alarm, because they know it's real. They know that the thing we are talking about is real, whether it's, you know, the Great Replacement or the technocratic, the Great Reset. They're constantly lying. They're always lying. They're always trying to spread a fake worldview that basically everything's just fine. What are you moaning about? Everything's fine. It's fine for us to reduce the farming sector by 30% in a country. It's fine for us to replace the population. It's fine for us to tell 8-year-old children that they might want to change their sex. Well, I mean, it really doesn't take much thought to realize that none of that is fine. This is extremely perverse and wrong, and would have shocked even most people alive today would have been shocked by this stuff 10 years ago.
Well, I think quite a lot of people alive today refuse to believe it's actually happening. When I talk to my father and people of my father's generation, who is actually genuinely a boomer, he always thinks I'm heavily exaggerating all these things. And these are just incidental little trends or just a few crazy people here and there. And it's very hard to get into their heads that, no, genuinely, this is very pervasive at 11.
I don't know how people older than us can say that. You know, they've, because I remember, my memory goes back at best to the mid 80s, but really not even that. It's just very blurry memories of, yeah, the late 80s. But the boomers, they can remember back to the 50s.
Yeah.
So they've seen a lot more. Like, I've seen change in my lifetime that surprises even me and shocks me and has done for a long time. Going back 10, 15 years, they've seen a lot more change. And so how can that, and this is what I always wonder, like, what, like pop stars, you know, Paul McCartney, Bono, and, you know, Bono's a particular example. I don't want to get into that, but I'm just talking about people of that age. They have seen so much change. I mean, even like relations between men and women, for example. I mean, they can remember the 70s. For fuck's sake. When it was a completely different world then. How can they not see it? This is all a bit fucked up. What's going on now? When even you and I can see it.
Yes. Well, if I were to take the example of my father and how I think he sees this, he was a leftist during the May 1968 student thing and when it all started kicking off, really. And to him, up until the early 2000s, all of this was actually good, the progress made. You know, oh, gay marriage and free sex and liberalizing drugs and more socialist policies and so on. He thought this was all progress. And then now what's been happening in the last 5 to 10 years with the government becoming very openly undemocratic and ignoring procedure with all the transgender crazy stuff, he can't really face the fact that is real, that's the effect of what the policies he supported, and he just kind of dismisses it as fringe idiots who will go away and we'll get back to, you know, the liberal dream of eventually we'll reach utopia. This is just some bump on the road. And I think that's for a lot of baby boomers particularly the case. And as I was saying, I think for it's extremely hard for most people to actually face the fact that society isn't there for them. Their interests aren't being represented. Politics are actually corrupt to the level that they are. And because it would force you to have to do something. You cannot sit by and let yourself be destroyed. And actually facing that fact is a very hard psychological step to take. And for us, as naturally sort of psychologically somewhat abnormal types, perhaps, because people in this circle are in some ways very contrarian and antisocial, and, you know, they've got traits that aren't the normative. And for normative people, it takes a lot for them to face the fact that society's against them. And then it takes a lot more for them to accept that they're going to have to do something about it. They're going to have to make for their own food security, for their own safety. They're going to have to take care of the education of their children, own children, if they don't want. And that's quite harsh, you know. They'll realize all the safety and security of a society that you thought was around you, to feel that falling away. And even if you've maybe at some subconscious level start realizing that, then you have to still have to take the actual step of accepting that.
Yeah, and in the case of the boomers, I think it also means that they've been wrong for a long time, all their lives. I mean, you know, and this is something where I actually feel sorry for them, because they always thought that Woodstock meant something and punk meant something, and the New Age, early 70s stuff, that it meant something, and free as a bird and no constraints and all that. They always thought that this meant something. And now they find out what it means. It means the pod. It means no religion. It means no purpose to your life whatsoever. It means that everything is done for you. It means that you have no freedom, that you have no real agency. It means that you're just a consumer and a blob. And that you really just don't matter at all to your own society, and certainly not to the people who govern it. So that's the result of Imagine. That's what it all actually leads to. Yes. And I think for the boomers, this is... too much to take in. They just can't handle it.
And at least when you had Christianity and a Christian morality, they would always be telling you that you are insignificant in the grand plan of God, and you can only do so much to save your soul, and that you've got a certain role within life. Whereas our society, of course, tells you that you can be anything you want. You can be a rock star. You can be the president of the United States. You can be an astronaut. Yeah,
and it's all about you. You matter. And what came with COVID was this, and I said this at the time, that this is the switching from individualism and consumerism and being selfish to actually you're nothing. Actually, and your individual goals really don't matter. And the best contribution you can make is to help look after your society by looking after granny and banging pots and pans for the NHS and whatever. So it's a real switch. But it's an unhealthy switch. At least Christianity kept people going and it gave them a transcendent purpose and all of that. Whatever you think about Christianity, at least it was a religion and one that was tried and tested by centuries.
Now, that's a saying. But this say what you want about Christianity. Reason. At least it was a religion.
Exactly. Well, the trouble is, I was going to say that, but then I realized I can't say that, because what we've got now is also a religion. It's just a weird... dysfunctional secular religion where there is no transcendence. You know, it's you're just molecules. You're just something that should exist in a pod for 70 years, 75 years, be sustained by artificial means, and then die one day. And you know, you've jacked off for 70 years.
That way,
of course not. They won't. But that's what it amounts to.
Yes, but they do present sort of this Hegelian idea that. Through all these challenges and so on, eventually we'll achieve progressive utopia and no one will have to suffer anymore. And we'll have paradise on earth. And I guess they kind of missed the point of Thomas More's book in general.
Indeed. Well, okay, let's leave it at that. I think this has been a very interesting discussion. I mean, I don't want to leave on a black-pilled note, but I mean, ultimately, as I said, I don't think they're going to get what they want. I think it is going to blow up in their face. I don't think they can sustain a dystopia indefinitely. It just goes against human nature. Everything that we're seeing goes not caring about your nation, not identifying with your ethnic group, not identifying as male or female, the whole trans stuff and child sex stuff is just utterly perverse. Not having agency, not having a stake in your society, not having the ability to set your own path in life, no transcendent purpose. All of this goes against human nature at its in a most profound way. And so I don't think it is sustainable by definition. It's just, and I do think a lot of it is just reliant on luxury. I do think that, but that's the big question. What will happen when the luxury goes? But yeah, that's something that we're just going to have to wait and see.
I'll have some.
So, all right. Well, yes, well, yeah, go for it.
I think we talk a lot about geopolitics and a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of economic and so on. But I think that, and that's mostly what these streams are always about. But really, my experience has really been the most positive is working with people who share the same ideas in a physical space with you. And I would really recommend that instead of looking at the world at such a grand scale, which at some level you, of course, have to, but I would say look at this locally as possible and see what you can do locally, you know, because in the end, you're going to need a community to survive these trying times and find like-minded friends and insulate yourself as much as possible from whatever is coming.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And a number of people have said that this year and last year. And I dare say people will take a while to make that transition, but I hope that a lot of people do because, you know, it is probably what's going to be necessary, especially as, you know, this awful transition to smart cities and loads of Africans everywhere. You know, you're going to have to adapt and to avoid that. So, all right, let's get to the super chats since I criminally forgot them with the previous stream. I'm sorry about that. Ayatollah is going to answer them on his own show tomorrow night, incidentally. So people can tune into that. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, how long does Faust give the West?
Depends how you define the West. I think some of the very core ideas and philosophy of it will survive because it is their discoveries of underlying fundamental truths, and maybe the formulation will change, but I think certain philosophical ideas, sort of like the idea of empiricism and so on, will survive. And cultural forms, I've got a video on my channel called The Death of Forms. I think everything like that is transitory.
Okay. I'm going to watch that video afterwards. That sounds very interesting. All right. Caesar himself says, yo ho ho. Thank you very much. Piers Taylor donated $10. Thank you. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, what is the name of Faust's favorite Trappist beer?
Oh, these are Belgian beers. They're sort of heavier beers. Trappists are an order of monks. And so they brew beers. There's a funny story about one abbot who... he fought in one of the battles of between the Flemish and the French, and he was a brewer, and he ended up murdering someone in over a dispute over how to brew beer, and he was as a punishment he had to take the crusade, and he was killed at the siege of Rhodes, and he ended up there because he had a dispute over the correct way to brew a proper beer. But my favorite one, I'd probably say Leffe. It's very boring, but Leffe is nice.
All right. Actually, I'll put in a question here. What's your favorite cheese this year?
I hate to admit it, but I do like Brie and Gruyere. And if we take anything from the French, it's the cheese.
Well, Gruyère, is that not Swiss?
Oh, yes. But it's the French-speaking part of Switzerland.
Of course.
Yeah, and you know, there's these countries in Europe which shouldn't be countries, like Switzerland and Belgium.
Okay. All right. I've actually discovered a new cheese this year. And it's, let me think, where is it from? It is actually a French cheese, but it seems like a Dutch cheese, but it's actually French. And it's called Tom de Berry, T-O-M-M-E de Berry. It's very nice indeed. It's like a mature Gouda, which, as you know, I'm a great fan of.
Yes.
All right, but it's very nice. Okay, who owns the most land in the Netherlands? Is it like Britain, where the monarch and its appendages, the Duke of Cornwall, etc., or has Holland got BlackRock and Bill Gates buying it all up?
Technically, every piece of land in the Netherlands is property of the Dutch state. And you don't own, but you rent for life and it unto your descendants. But So technically everything is part of the Dutch state. Who owns the most land here? Actually, there's probably no big major investors or anything like that holding it here. It's probably going to be something boring like Shell or something, because they've got a lot of industrial area. I wouldn't exactly know, but I don't think it's like BlackRock or anything like that.
Okay. Oliver Oliverson asks, and I think that this might be someone else using a pseudonym, asks me, does Amsterdam always make you think of Van der Valk? Now, Van der Valk, in case Faust doesn't know, is a TV drama from the 70s about, I think it's a detective show. It was a British show, but it was made in the Netherlands. Maybe a co-production, I'm not sure. But the thing is, even though I'm a fan of TV of that era, I've actually never seen Van der Valk. So I'm sorry about this. I have no experience of it. Apparently the theme tune to the program is very good. There we go. I love Amsterdam for other reasons. But yeah, sorry, go on.
I thought he was referring to the hotel chain. We've got a big hotel chain over here called Van der Valk.
Oh, maybe that is it. there's a guy who asks me quite frequently about theme tunes, and he seems to have a particular fetish for the Van der Valk theme tune. So I assumed that was this guy using a pseudonym to sneak a question in. But yeah, maybe it's about the hotel chain. But no, Amsterdam, I don't smoke dope, right? I'm not one of those.
I don't smoke dope and I don't visit prostitutes, but I have been seen in the red light district.
With you. So, but yeah, I like the atmosphere, and I'll tell you what, I much prefer being around people who are high than people who are drunk. And I know that's a rather dorky thing to say, but it is the truth. But as for Amsterdam, it's a beautiful city. The architecture is lovely. The buildings are lovely. The layouts, just the general atmosphere, the general tone of life there is nice. And you know, just in terms of people watching, there are an incredible abundance of very attractive young Dutch women in Amsterdam, rather similar to Copenhagen in Denmark or Helsinki in Finland. But obviously, I would never say that you should go there just for that reason. That would be perverse. But yeah, there are very pretty girls there. But that's just a bonus. Generally speaking, what's great about Amsterdam is the atmosphere. But I would say also that Utrecht is also beautiful. And Utrecht is like Amsterdam, but less touristy and much more quiet. But it's a similar sort of feel, similar sort of architecture and layout. Very lovely.
There's a few more cities like beautiful. That. You would probably like Leiden. Harlem.
I don't think I was ever there.
Yeah.
And I haven't been there. I've only really been to the ones that you took me to.
Yeah.
And I think we were going to go to Leiden, but we didn't for some reason. Can't remember.
Could be.
But yeah, it's just a lovely country. I mean, I really do have a lot of affection for
Once you're done with your walking tour of Great Britain, you could do a walking tour of the Netherlands.
It would probably be a lot less onerous with all the flat land. Yeah, well, maybe indeed. All right. Okay, here's another one from Black Pigeon Pill. Why does Faust hate the British?
Well, you're like, you know, evil, and you invented liberalism, like the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the introduction of a parliament that restrains the sovereignty of the king. I'm more of a Holy Roman Empire guy myself, where we have an absolute emperor with absolute authority, but at the same time, we've got 700 different counties and countries all with their own laws, and we all obey the emperor, but, you know, we're kind of doing our own thing. We don't need no formal parliament and bills of rights to be, you know, giving the peasants any ideas.
Okay. Inso asks, Pure Blood said, help for haircut. Merry Christmas, chaps. Thank you very much. Very generous. Inso asks, what happened to the young chap challenging him? I think that was Mark Rutter, about the Schwab connection. Has he continued to challenge and expose him? I think this was about challenging the Prime Minister on his connections to Klaus Schwab.
Yes, this did happen, and he at first simply said he didn't know who he was. then when they dig further, he just said, oh yeah, I met him once. And he basically, he completely circled around and then gave a non-answer to it. And yeah, it's funny to watch. If you, there's maybe a video of it subtitled in Dutch, but yeah, it's not very easy to explain because it's just kind of weird to watch.
Yeah, but Insel was asking what happened to the young guy who was doing that, who said that.
Oh, he's still in Parliament. That was, I think it was either Van Meijer or it was Baudet himself. But he's still in Parliament. And as I said, they are trying to see if they can ban the party. But you have quite broad immunity from, if you have, as a politician, you have got immunity as political speech, so you can say a lot more than you would as a regular citizen.
Yeah, there's got a similar thing in Britain, parliamentary privilege, which is quite amazing when you think about it. Okay, well, anyway, let's leave it at that. This has been a very interesting discussion, and a very interesting indeed, and I thank you for it.
Yes.
I've enjoyed it. So thank you very much. I will be back in half an hour with the German publishing house Jung. Hold on a second. I want to get this right. Jung Europa Verlag. But in the meantime, Faust, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Yes, thank you for having me, and maybe you'll come visit us again sometime.
I would like that. I really would like that. So, yeah, hopefully. All right. Thank you, everyone. I'll see you soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Get the info you need at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.